All right, so good evening, and this is going to be the first talk in a series about the five aggregates. This is, in my opinion, kind of a big topic, and what's valuable about it is that the suttas, that the talks that the historical Buddha gave about this provide a formula that is repeated in many other areas of practice. So there is, as you know, the focus of the Buddhist teaching in the long run was about the arising of wisdom. And then there's a series of practices that are specifically designed to foster the arising of wisdom as opposed to things that support the arising of wisdom. So for example, the practices of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity are supportive practices that create this entire foundation, which is part of the foundation that allows wisdom to arise. Okay. So, and then there are wisdom practices. So I'm going to start with the five aggregates, which I think are very interesting, in part because it does outline this formula, and then over the next 6 months, each one of us, Diane and Rich and myself, are going to take various pieces of this text that Bhikkhu Bodhi has put together. It's an anthology of suttas, and he's gone in and he's pared them down, eliminated a lot of the repetitive language, made them easier for the Western reader, and particularly for someone who's not familiar with how to read a sutta. Okay. So we thought that this would be a good starting place, but the value of them is that they really reveal a lot of the structure of the way the historical Buddha puts things together. And you can see his thinking, and you can see how logical his approach was, and also how heavily deconstructional his approach was in practice, and we're going to explore a little bit of what that means. But as a starting place, the historical Buddha said this. There are these four lights. What four are these? The light of the moon, the light of the sun, the light of fire, and the light of wisdom. And of these four lights, the light of wisdom is supreme. And so he used a lot of teaching stories and analogies about fire and the moon and the sun. But here, he's really talking about the core of the teaching methodology, the investigative methodology that he laid out is about the arising of wisdom. So we're going to start with the five aggregates, and the five aggregates are physical form, the body, and this is to be distinguished from the idea in Buddhism that you have probably heard of called nama, rupa, body, and mind, which is a single integrated system. In the Buddhist approach to looking at the body and the mind, they aren't different. So that the belief is that the body is infused with wisdom, so that these heavy body practices are actually designed to unlock the wisdom that is stored in the body. And so there's a sutta where the Buddha talks about the, I don't know if it's the 32 or the 37 or the 24, I forget the number, but it's names for awakening. And the point of the sutta basically is that the notion of awakening is so beyond our normal framework of understanding at this conventional level of awareness that you can't describe it rationally. You can't describe it cognitively, so you have to use some metaphor. So maybe it's the metaphors, the 27 metaphors, and they're all like the unbounded, the unimaginable, and on and on. But the fascinating part about that sutta is these descriptions are given, as I recall, I think two, maybe three, but I think in two big paragraphs. And the introduction and then the closing right after each one of the paragraphs that has all the metaphors says, how does one experience awakening? And the answer is one experiences awakening through directing attention into the body. So this Buddhist idea of Namarupa is, you know, of course, way predated our idea of, about integration in body and mind, but it's much, much more than the Western idea of it. It's actually the idea that the body is infused with wisdom, so that things like body scans and paying attention to the arising of sensations in the body are actually potential resources for the release of spontaneous wisdom and insight. It's a fascinating and important idea. So these five things, physical form, mental or volitional formations, which are very, very deep habits of mind that are kind of embedded in us. They're so deep out of trauma or experience or belief or assumption or family of origin experiences. Consciousness, perception, and then feeling, which we're talking about feeling in the Buddhist sense of an initial reaction to experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay, so the five aggregates are the physical body, the consciousness that arises in the nama-rupa, the perception, the ability of the mind to identify separate events and distinguish them, right? The feeling tone that arises when the perception occurs as a result of contact. So just as a starting place, those are the five, and then we'll talk about how those fit. By definition, these are all sources of short-term gratification because they all are related to our sense doors. Okay. And by definition, they're a guarantee of continuing suffering. Because what comes along with the short-term gratification is a misperception that the mind grabs onto, that the short-term gratification can actually become long-term gratification. So that the mind seeks after, I seek after, certain experiences on the false assumption that if I just get enough of that same experience, that I'll suddenly become satisfied, you know. And then, so the mind starts clinging to that, right? And the negative formula and the term for the aggregates are the five aggregates of or subject to clinging, subject to attachment. So it's not just that, well, gee, there's these five interesting things, you know, physical form, consciousness, perception. But no, it's that these five things in particular are subject to the mind grabbing onto them, clinging to it, attachment. And when attachment occurs, the mind tends to identify with it, right? We tend to identify with our consciousness, with our body, with our perceptions, with our feelings. So with identification comes what? Personalization and suffering. So it's this fantastic, terrible little package that makes us suffer, okay? So in every short-term sense of gratification is the misperception that there is a potential long-term satisfaction there. And you would think after we do something over and over again so many times that somehow we would get it, right? And eventually, with the right kind of practice, we do. But if we're not practicing, we don't. That's the fascinating thing. And the reason is what? Because it's driven by either desire or aversion. And desire and aversion doesn't have any wisdom in it. So as long as what the driver is desire and aversion, as opposed to the driver being wisdom, observation, listening, allowing things to unfold, watching them, you know, then it's a guarantee of suffering. So the Buddha said in this particular sutta, said, as long as I did not directly know each of the five aggregates subject to clinging as they really are, I was subject to clinging and suffering in four different phases or ways. Okay? So as long as I did not directly know each of the five aggregates subject to clinging as they really are, I was subject to clinging and suffering in four different phases or ways. So why is that significant when he says, when I did not directly know? Well, there's kind of a traditional formula of practice, and there's if you know, like if you were to go into a monastery, if you went into a monastery at the time of the Buddha, it's still pretty much the same. There would be study. There would be listening or hearing the Dharma, and Dharma talks. There would be reflecting on what you study or heard. I'm going to add one other that we don't seem to do, but is fascinating and has some, I think, big possibilities, and that is a certain kind of repetition, so that younger monks are required to memorize whole suttas and then repeat them back to the younger monks behind them. So the memorization of very long suttas, and in the memorization a whole kind of learning takes place, because you see the relationship of words or the choice of words, which you might not pick up if you weren't having to actually memorize it, you know. And then you see relationships of ideas and concepts. So that was another element. But it's all capped by what in Buddhism we call direct non-conceptual experience. And this is through the meditative process. And what arises from this direct encounter with the experience itself, not an idea about the experience and not a concept about the experience and not a belief about it, or an assumption, but the actual experience itself, what arises from that spontaneously, is an insight into its true and deepest nature of how it works. And in Buddhism, that's what we call wisdom. So wisdom and insight are fully interchangeable. Okay? Whenever you hear either of those terms, that's what we're talking about. Now, the important part about this is that the wisdom that we're talking about is not wisdom, at least in this context. Okay. The wisdom that we're talking about is not conventional wisdom. It's not the product of thought or thinking. The study and the hearing and the reflection is really important to help set up a framework that points the mind in a particular direction and into the experience. But the insight, the wisdom, is not conceptual or intellectual. And it isn't the product of psychological or emotional work or work on a self-referential story. That's not what wisdom means in this context. Wisdom means something much greater than that. It pierces either, however you want to think about it, it transcends all of those things. It transcends ideas, concepts, personal story, psychological, emotional issues. It dives under them. It pierces through them. And what is revealed is the deepest understanding of the experience itself, how the experience unfolds. what is the mechanism? You know, in medicine, any of you who are in medicine, you know, are obsessed with knowing the mechanism. You know, and the reason that we have the longest drug approval process of any country in the world is we have to prove what the mechanism is of why it works. The fact that it works is not enough to get it approved in the United States. And the vast majority of drugs that are on the market right now, which, you know, were approved year ago, would not get on the market now because we still don't know what the mechanism is for of how they work. All we know is that they work and they're reliable, but that's not enough. We've got to know the mechanism, okay? So this goes down to that level, and this is the reason we say that at least these particular approaches are deconstructional, because the Buddha's asking you to look at an experience and take the experience apart. The experience itself, okay? Not what you believe about the experience, not a story about the experience, not assumptions, none of those things. The experience itself that you're experiencing in this moment. I'll try to use some illustrations in a second. So, and so the key thing is that this actually is a process, and it involves our attention and mindfulness, and it involves knowing where and how to put our attention to examine something and to explore it. And so that's what we're going to do. So let me start with a brief illustration, and this is a lot of this for me is important setup to understand. I was saying this whole kind of basic formula that's outlined in the sutta. And so Suzuki Roshi, who is a very famous Zen teacher, he's no longer alive now. He founded the San Francisco Zen Center back in the 60s, and people would come in, and for those of us who were around in the 60s, you know, everybody's talking about freedom. That was one of the big slogans. And so they would go in and talk with Suzuki Roshi, and they would say, you know, we came here because we hear that you can teach us how to be free. You know, we want to be free. And he said, well, I think I probably can, but what you mean by freedom and what I mean by freedom may be two different things. Okay. Which it frequently did back then. So, and then Suzuki Roshi, at the end of the quotation, is what I mean by freedom is a calm and a clear mind. Okay, what I mean by freedom is a calm and a clear mind. And so that sounds like, you know, a very pithy little story. But what does it mean? Why is it important? Because I think it's actually quite important. And it's pointing to the idea, Suzuki Roshi was pointing to the idea that what we're trying to do in practice is change the baseline in our mind. And what we're trying to do through all these practices is we are trying to create a mind that is spacious and open and receptive, that it is prepared and ready for experience. And it doesn't have a bunch of other things in it, that we're trying to have an open, spacious, receptive, you know, sometimes we say non-judgmental, non-reactive mind, but it's this basic quietness of mind that's ready to receive experience. And this is one of the definitions of emptiness. Now, to explain it, it'd take a little bit of explanation, but the easiest is that the mind is empty of all the things that disturbs the balance of the mind. Okay. Does that work? So this is like a huge idea. It's like, well, what? All these practices, what are we trying to do? You know, it's like, well, we're trying to create a mind where right now I can just sit here. And then when something arises, this is the importance of it, when something arises, because my mind is in balance, because my mind is empty, that I can actually see that arise. You know, there's this whole field of spacious calmness in my mind. So if something arises up over here, you know, a thought pops up over here, or an emotion pops up over here, or there's a sound and an assumption jumps up over here, or whatever it is, I can actually see that separate and apart from the field. And more importantly, I can see the impact or the influence it has on my quiet and spacious mind. I can see that it disturbs my mind, disturbs the balance, or it creates agitation, or it changes the energy in my mind or my body. You know, we can just go on and on and on. Okay, but this notion of being able to observe, and we use the term discern, different experiences from each other, this is what we're talking about. Now, frequently, you know, we won't have an empty mind. You may have noticed this. But you know, so it's not as if like, well, gee, I'm going to practice and then suddenly just an empty mind, okay? But through all of these practices, like we learn how to work with thinking and what have you, you know, you can have a lot of thinking going through your mind and not have an agitated mind. So that your mind actually is quite spacious and relatively open, even though all this thinking is just kind of rolling on in the background. Mm-hmm. You know? You can have a certain level of emotion or emotionality, you know, or anxiety. And if the mind is holding it in a particular way where it's not annoyed by the anxiety and trying to suppress it and get away from it, that it's accepted that this is happening, that you can have this relatively spacious field with a certain level of anxiety and still have this ability to see things arise. So it's important to understand that this isn't, you know, we're not talking about fantasy here. We're talking about how do we take these concepts, and there's an ideal, you know, where we would like to get to, and we do get there. You know, on retreat and in daily saying, we do get to these places where the mind has this kind of emptiness. And then we have other places where you know, the mind is terribly agitated and confused and overwhelmed and distraught, and the notion of what I'm talking about right now, you know, you try to introduce that to the mind, and it, you know, it laughs at you. You know, it's like, oh, okay, sure. So it's everything in between, right? I mean, this is the nature of being human and practicing. And as we practice, we get better. You know, it gets better. So one of the things that's important to hear, like when you ask the question, well, what is it that would disturb the balance of the mind? Okay, well, you know, it could be a strong emotion. It could be desire. It could be aversion. It could be an assumption. It could be a belief. It could be a projection, on and on. But for purposes of tonight's talk, and like a really core, let's get down to it, are the five aggregates of clinging. Because if the mind is clinging, it cannot be in the spacious, open, receptive place. Can't do it. Okay? So the title, by definition, tells you that if the mind is clinging to these, that they are obstacles to mindfulness and clear seeing. That's part of the importance of the Buddha phrasing that way. Okay, it's like up in neon, the five aggregates of clinging. Okay. So, all right. So when we are clinging, we are seeing through what we are clinging through or identified with rather than seeing the thing itself. That's the problem. Right? This is what the Buddha called delusion, illusion, ignorance. You know? We keep doing something, you know, drinking, eating, sex, whatever it may be. We keep overindulging in the hope that that's going to provide us with some form of satisfaction. We keep driving that way. So, illusion, delusion. And we're seeing through that, through the hope, the desire, the wish, the assumption, that that in fact will happen. So we cannot see clearly when the mind is clean. So this is the reason that we spend so much time talking about seeing clinging. Because if we're actually caught in clinging, we almost assuredly move into identification, and then we're personalizing, and we can't see a thing other than what we're seeing through a completely self-referential story about what's going on. That's it. That's what we get. So, guaranteed to suffer. So that's the reason in practice, the how do we see clinging? How do we see identification? Okay, so let's try to apply that to the five aggregates. And as a reminder again, you know, they're the physical form, mental formations, consciousness, perception, and feeling. So the first question I'd just kind of like to pose here real quickly is, these should sound awfully familiar. And do they sound familiar? They sound familiar, right? Okay. So why do they sound familiar? Anybody have a guess?
Because they're part of the links of the chain of dependent origination.
That's exactly right. Did everybody hear that? They're part of the links of the chain of dependent origination, of the process leading to attachment identification, and you know, it's the chain of becoming and then suffering. Okay, so you have the physical form, you know, like if you look at the original version, this fascinating part for me, and I'm not sure that I completely understand it yet, other than it's making such a huge point. You would think that the chain would be, well, there's a physical form, and then there's a mental formation, you know, that's sitting in the body and mind, and then when contact occurs, consciousness, perception, and feeling all arise simultaneously. That's the mechanism. Okay, those three of the five, consciousness, perception, and feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, arise simultaneously with a sense door contacting a sense object. So, you know, I look at the tanka here. So there is eye consciousness arises when I look at that. And eye perception arises when I look at that. And a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, it may be very subtle, arises all simultaneously when I look at that. And so for each one of the sense doors, while we tend to relate to things, and this is how, from the Buddhist perspective, we get in trouble, as all of our sense doors and everything operating simultaneously as a unitary function, the Buddha would say there's eye consciousness, and that is a separate and different thing. It may be tightly related, but a separate and different thing than ear consciousness. So I hit this. There's contact with the bell, which produces a sound wave, and if my eardrum is okay, it touches, and when it touches here, suddenly there's ear consciousness. There's perception related to that. I distinguish this, you know, a copper bowl from a brass bowl, and pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You know, I like this kind of bowl, the sound of this, than a different other kind of bowl. And so, with touching a sensation, That's separate. So the Buddha's theory was is that if we could relate to each one of these in that way, you start to break down the assumption and projections of the mind that come to conclusions about clinging and identification and selfing. Because it just starts becoming so obvious, they're not all a single thing. And then when they're not a single thing, well, what are they? You know? So you've got those three, but the part that was always interesting for me is what precedes them is, well, there's the physical body in which the senses are housed, right? And you would kind of think logically, well, that would be the first link of dependent origination. Well, there's got to be a body, because if there's a body and there's no senses in it, how could some chain of any experience start arising? And actually, the first chain, or the first link in the chain, is mental formations before the body. So on one level, I think that it is indicative of like how deeply entrenched these mental formations are, and at another level, I think it is linked to the notion that in the Buddha's framework of the world, there are multiple lifetimes, so that these mental formations that are not purified out, you know, the basic model of awakening is that the mind is purified of these mental formations, and the ones that aren't, they're still here, they're still hanging around and manifest themselves in another human body. So back to the Buddha said, as long as I did not directly know each of the five aggregates subject to clinging as they really are, I was subject to clinging and suffering in four different phases or ways. So I want to address this, because this is the core of this sutta, okay, and of dealing with the five aggregates. Because we would tend to think of form, a mental formation, a consciousness, as things, as a separate something. Okay, there is a mental formation embedded in my body or my mind, and it's just waiting to be triggered. Okay, and that my body is a thing, a separate thing, and that when perception arises, that is a separate and discrete thing. And from a Buddhist perspective, what's important to appreciate is the Buddha's talking about, when he says aggregates, he's talking about five separate experiences. Because I don't experience ear consciousness or sound consciousness until that happens. And you can just tell from this that this is a changing experience. Things have to come together in order for that experience to arise. I have to look at that tanka to have that particular I consciousness and perception and the experience that flows from it. And so whatever the sense story is, that's the case. So the Buddha's not asking us to like examine our body. He's asking us to examine the experience that arises from the body. Okay. So let's take feeling tone. That consciousness, perception, and feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, arise simultaneously. And this feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral is related to the mental formation. That's what colors and makes it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then if we don't catch that, that starts to escalate up. That leads to attachment, to identification, to suffering. So the four things that the Buddha said, the four phases, or the four ways that I would suffer, have to do with either seeing it clearly or not seeing it clearly. If I see it clearly, it gives me the possibility of not suffering. If I don't see it, then I just drop into attachment or identification. All right. So the first thing is whatever the experience itself. So in this case, it's the feeling tone, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, of actually seeing that there is a feeling tone, a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And those are different things. And not adding anything on to that experience. Just is what it is. Okay? Just experiencing it directly. So the way of not understanding it would be to, first of all, just completely miss it in the sense that, well, pleasant and unpleasant or neutral's there, but there's a complete disconnect from how it got there. You know, that it's actually arising from something. It's like, well, pleasant and unpleasant or neutral, and then I'm not aware of its potential consequence. So right at the threshold of the experience itself. So that would be the first part. The second was the origin of feeling. So the origin is this. So that the mind is actually perceiving that there is a process, a mechanism that's unfolding in any given moment that produces that. So that the mind and the heart both start looking to what? Causation and conditionality. You know, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral doesn't arise unless something preceded it. What is what preceded it? And then that principle begins to apply to everything in Buddhist practice. So then the mind starts relating in that particular way, looking to just immediately before the experience. The reason it wants to do that is because it has consequences in terms of understanding. So the third area was the actual cessation or the ending of whatever the experience is. And here, the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, when does it end? Anybody have a guess? Excuse me?
When the sound ends.
When there's a lack of contact, right? Yeah. So, you know, if when I hit this, the person in the back row will hear it for one length of time. The person in the front row will hear it for another length of time. I'll hear it longer than just about anybody else in the room. This thing goes on for a long time. It's amazing. And when it settles down, it's still vibrating, and there's this fine little hum, okay? But then once that vibration that is a sound wave going into my ear stops, no contact, no pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? So this is like a big understanding. If you're looking for, you know, the next, where this is all going is, well, what causes suffering to arise? You know, what causes suffering to cease? You know, and I'm sure it's not going to be too much of a surprise. It has something to do with contact. So you start training yourself rather, you know, a lot of his technique was rather than, you know, the suffering is right in your face, I'm going to take that suffering on. It's secondary in nature. You know, he breaks down experience. And through that experience, we learn how things arise, how things end, and through that, why they cause us to suffer. And it's much less threatening than taking on the direct suffering itself. And it teaches the mind to relate to things in a very skillful way, which is less high risk. I mean, it's much easier for me to do this. And just, I'm sitting in my living room, so I'm just going to practice. Okay, I'm just, well, it's true, you know. Like there was no hearing consciousness until there was contact. And then I can see my perception of that bell. It changes. I have a reaction to that bell. I have that experience. And so I can do that. That's much different than saying to somebody that I'm really struggling with in a relationship, hey, let's sit down and I want you to say that thing to me again that you said a half hour ago that pissed me off so much. You know, it's a little more difficult, okay? But if I'm doing this in my sitting meditation regularly, and that I'm doing it with each one of them, suddenly it becomes much easier to have certain discussions. Because now my mind is looking for what is it that causes something to arise in the field that disturbs it, okay? And then my reactivity is lower because of that. And then the more I do that, the stronger my mind becomes, and the more adaptable my mind comes, and the more resilient my mind becomes in terms of being able to maintain this flexibility. Okay, and then, so the first one was, the Buddha said, unless I know it directly, I cling and I suffer in five different ways. The experience or thing itself, its origin, its cessation, and then the last one is the way leading to cessation. So the reason that it's in that order, you know, you could say, well, the order should be origin, the way that leads to cessation, and then cessation. I mean, like, why didn't you do it that way? That's obviously the order. And the idea is that, okay, you see it arise. Okay. You see it end, right? Okay. So now, now I know that. I know that there is a cause for something arising. Anger, fear, resentment, anxiety, whatever it is, lust. And I know there's an ending for it, and it has something to do with my mind or my heart coming in contact with it. Okay, now, what tools can I use to move my mind towards cessation of the suffering that is caused? Does that work? And so then, that's training the mind to first of all see that, to avoid contact that causes the mind to suffer, or if there has been contact, to learn how to diminish it or get out of it as quickly as possible. So this little formula of the experience itself, the origin of the experience, the cessation of the experience, and the way leading to will replicate itself over and over and over and over again through many, many different teachings in many parts of the suttas. It's all over it may sound familiar because it's all over the Satipatthana Sutra, the core sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness. Same formula that's in there. Maybe worded slightly different. Same formula. So, I find it interesting that basically is the sutta. You know, some of these suttas are very long and complex and interrelated and what have you, but I mean, this one is like, it's not short, but it's very direct. And it stays exactly to these points that I've talked about. Because there's two terms that the Buddha has used that were confusing to me, and I've only begun to understand them in the last 3 or 4 years. And one was, he would talk about training the mind to become disenchanted with something. Okay? And my understanding of what that means is that part of the process of clinging Clinging is driven by desire or aversion. And so the mind is enchanted by, is aroused beyond normal limits on something, so it clings to it. So that we're trying to see that the mind fantasizes about and makes things more exciting or worse than they actually are. You know, like I've had an experience, you know, it's a good thing when your practice gets to a stage where, although you have to take responsibility for your mind, you know it's not you. Mm-hmm. Because the stuff that your mind does is so humiliating. And the past couple of days, you know, a study came out of Harvard in the last couple of years that said, and who knows if any of these studies are true, but it basically said that 47% of the time, your mind is just filled with random thoughts. It's just thinking that you have no control over at all. And I tend to believe that. I don't know about the 47%, but you know, just all these thoughts, and then you have the experience like I've had the last 2 days where my mind is just, it's papancha, you know, it's this proliferation of thinking which is negative and become obsessional, and it's focused on something, and it, you know, it seems like this particular 2 day period for me, normally I do pretty good with this, like just cannot get rid of it. You know, the only thing you can do is just, you know, okay, let it go. That's part of the background sound, and you know it's going to wear itself out. Okay, but it's you know, if you actually said to yourself, "Well, that's me," it's like, "Gee, let's give up." You know, you're like, "Holy smokes, that's incredible!" But so the disenchantment part is that you know it. In this particular instance, it's enchanted with the anger and the resentment, and it's driven by this anxiety, you know, that's, I'm not going to give you the details, caused by something else. So the reaction of the mind is anger and resentment, and the mind is just enchanted with that. That's the reason it keeps going, you know? That's what just keeps it going, right? So at some point, and you can start to see this after you've practiced for a while, this shift takes place, and your mind actually recognizes how unskillful this is, and that it's going to keep you suffering. And the mind's interest in it, its enchantment, starts to wane. I mean, you can actually begin to feel it, you know. And so, where before it would keep up like it has the last 2 days, but it only lasts an hour, you know. Or, and then some time ago, I don't know if this is like a great illustration of progress, but earlier in my life, this thing that has been going on for 2 days, I'm not joking, would have gone on for 10 days. That, you know, my mind would have just held on to it, you know. So I can actually see that there's, as painful as it is, that you know there's some progress. But the mind starts to the allure. You know, another way we could call it is, you know, the drama. I mean, like some people are addicted to chaos. You know, they just love that in their life. They love to create chaos in their life and their family's life and everything and. So that stops, that starts slowly to be less interesting. The drama becomes less interesting and it keeps waning, okay? And then, you know, and it's not like it happens on everything. It happens on, you know, there's bars of things, you know. One way to think of it is that, like, there's some topic that, you know, has plagued you all your life. And you've done a lot of work on it, and now it, you know, there's not much juice there anymore. And then there's this other one that you really haven't done much work on, and actually because of your practice, it's just recently been revealed to you that this thing that you've been doing all your life that you thought was so skillful actually is quite screwed up and hurting you and hurting everybody else and ill-motivated. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, you know. And the moment before you had that insight, you thought that it was a good thing, you know. So then that one just has all kinds of charge on. So some this disenchantment will be, you know, really be happening, and others it's not even barely happening. But on the ones where this disenchantment has really started to take hold, the next thing that happens, and this was just by the term, was confusing to me, and it kind of raises, well, maybe I don't even want this in my life. And he talks about being dispassionate. And I know the reaction in my mind, and people I would talk with to try to understand, they would say, well, I don't want all the passion to go out of my life. No, I don't want to be dispassionate. And, you know, like so many other things, the Buddha's talking about specific things. What the Buddha's talking about is suffering, okay? So that as this disenchantment wanes, in the same way that when your mind, the mind is spacious and open and receptive, it can see things arise and it can see the consequence or the influence, here, when this disenchantment around chaos and drama or whatever it is starts to calm down, for the first time you can really genuinely see how dangerous what is there is to your life in terms of harming yourself and others, and causing you to suffer and others to suffer. And so this thing starts to set in out of that recognition of the danger of it on the one hand and the healthiness of not doing it on the other, that the Buddha calls dispassion. I no longer have this urge to engage into this, to hold on to this thing, to keep it going. You know. So it starts with the enchantment starts to turn to disenchantment, and then it moves into becoming dispassionate. And then if that works, you know, the long-term goal is that then we actually do on that particular issue have an open, spacious, receptive mind. We have an empty mind that we then have a chance to deal with things in real time and see them clearly rather than seeing them through enchantment or a certain kind of negative, unhealthy passion. So that is that's the start of the discussion on the four aggregates, or the five aggregates. I said four just to see if you were awake. So we've got time for a few questions or comments if there are any. That's a good one. And, you know, there's a series of, they're not so much Buddhist practices like in our tradition or in the Zen tradition, but there are some of the other schools where they ask those kinds of questions. Like, well, who is it that's thinking? You know, who is it that's feeling that? Who is it that's hearing that? You know? And so it becomes a repetitive question that you're carrying around with you all the time, you know, as an open experiential question, you know, not to ruminate on it, you know, to start another, but just like, what happens, right? And it's kind of like that, you know how you'll, there will be these exercises where you'll break into dyads, and one person just keeps asking the same question over and over and over again. And at the beginning, what tends to happen is that you get the answer that, you know, you long held and become kind of the belief system, right? And then if you're open to it, you just keep asking, and then these other things start to happen, to come out, you know, that color it differently and change it. And so that series of asking, there was a teacher named, I don't think, Packard. I want to say Jerry Packard, but it's not Jerry. But she was a very eclectic Zen teacher, and she, my recollection is, was head of the Boston Zen Center, and then went out, basically established a retreat center out in the woods someplace. And her whole method is just asking questions. That's her whole question. Her whole methodology is with these kinds of questions. And she came out with a book. I still have it. It's probably 15, 18 years old. And it's really fascinating because it takes all the stuff we normally work with and poses it in the questions. So thank you.
You know, in society now, what we see a lot in the media everywhere, much allurement with the body, sexuality. And it's interesting, in, not here, but in times, the Buddhists would contemplate a dead body or a corpse to, you know, really counteract that, to see, you know, what the body really is and what it, the end result is. So I'm just kind of tripping on that.
Yeah, yeah. They called it the seminary or charnel grounds, right? You know, and then there were the 32 parts of the body,
right?
You know, where you, the phlegm and all these different things. You know, and John Travis, you know, used to teach that. You know, I can remember going to retreats with John, and they were small retreats. You know, like 8, 10, 12 people. Up in Nevada City in the early 90s, and we'd have a practice where he would work you through those, and it'd take about an hour and a half. You know, so you're talking about connective tissue and bone and all this stuff, you know.
Not real popular these days here.
Yeah, not too much of a demand. But, you know, this thing about the charnel ground things is very powerful. And people who have gone on Buddhist pilgrimages to India and gone to some of the places there, you know, where they the burning ghats. If you arrive with the right state of mind, you know, like you're really a practitioner, it is very, if you're ripe, it's very powerful stuff. It creates a real shift for you. And how you relate to all of this. Actually, I always find it strange that you talk about, you know, sitting and watching a bunch of bodies burn being exciting. But that's absolutely been my experience of it. You know, it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Okay, one more.
When you said that one of the possibilities to deal with the suffering is to move away.
Is to?
To move away, to remove yourself. To move away, you said. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Because it feels to me like if you move away from what is causing the suffering, there is a little bit of aversion, and then If you're not able to deal directly with the suffering, that suffering will come again on another form. So, what exactly do you mean by moving away.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's really important to acknowledge that, you know, it's kind of a pop phrase in whether you're in a business meeting or you're in therapy about, well, you have to work with the person where they're at, okay? You know, which is kind of honoring the fact that not only are we all different, but we all have certain life experiences that have brought us to this moment, and that we have certain capacities that are quite strong and other capacities that aren't quite so strong. So that there is, well, you know, like we teach a beginning meditation course, like with, well, here's a whole series of different techniques that you can use, and this is like the standard, right? What we're trying to do is help people get a foothold in, and which of those work for you, and then how do we adapt that standard thing for you? So this is a long way of saying that whether it's learning the Dharma and learning some of these methods, or learning how to deal with suffering, we just have to be mindful that of what our capacities are and do so wisely, okay? So you just see all the time people getting, and this frequently happens on retreat, people get really excited about practice and the progress they're making and the possibilities of practice, you know, they maybe make a change in their life, and then they run out and they try to take something on that they're just not ready to take on. You know, their skill set isn't strong enough. So then they do that, and it's disastrous, you know? And so then they're confused, you know, is it me, or is it the Dharma, or the techniques were wrong, or, you know, is it the teaching, you know, all this stuff, right? So, you know, back to this idea of contact, that's when it, so that's ear consciousness, but then you start to see that it's the moment of contact that causes suffering to arise. So like there's a whole practice around the emptiness of mind practice where you just put yourself in a place and just watch what arises in the mind very, very carefully. And then you really start to see it's the same as this. You know, it's like that's a particular thought, and immediately I start to suffer. You know, so then the question becomes, what is skillful? It may be that that is a thought about something that is long past, that's never going to change, so that you know, you kind of need to look at that, and maybe part of the solution is that you need to stop having contact with it, you know. Or you realize that every time you think of a certain person, just that contact causes you to tighten up and to suffer. And so, well, what is it about that? You know, and maybe you see that you have a relationship with somebody that's quite toxic and is unhealthy for you, and the solution isn't to try to completely remake the whole relationship, because it's pretty clear that the other person isn't going to go along with that. So maybe the answer is to walk away from that relationship, you know? So there's a lot of different applications of that, but it all goes along with the idea of, you know, what is a reasonable, sensible, kind thing to do to take care of yourself and your environment and still make progress on the path, you know? So there's obviously the situation where, you know, I see that I'm making contact with a certain thought and I really dislike it, so I'm just not going to think about that anymore. And it's exactly what you should be engaging, right? So that your mind is fooling yourself, right? It's delusion that you could walk away from that thought. I mean, you can't walk away from that thought until you work with it, you know? So that's the reason, like, the title of this session is about the arising of wisdom through engaging the five aggregates subject to clinging. it's through the actual engagement. And then through that engagement, at some point, you realize, well, what's the next thing I do? And maybe I don't need to engage it anymore. You know, maybe I need to up my engagement with it. Okay, so thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much. Wonderful thing to be able to be here together. I would just like to encourage all of us. I want to be truthful. I'm still kind of disoriented about the situation that my country's in. And all the turbulence and confusion and all of the terrible wrong speech and disturbing conduct by all kinds of people. And I just want to encourage all of us to recognize that that's suffering. And I think that in our particular society right now, there's a lot more suffering than there was a year ago. You know, and so for us to just be a little bit kinder to ourselves and everybody that we come into contact with and try to support each other